My name is Earl R. Myers. I was born in St. Joseph, Missouri, at 3320 Seneca Street.
And when were you born?
February the 25th, 1920.
Tell them about when you were born and they put you behind the maid Aunt Mattie.
Oh, it was very cold back in 1920. Of course, I remember this. And it was snowing and blowing and drifting. And my grandmother, she was a German lady, and she was afraid I'd freeze to death. I was living in their home. She was afraid I'd freeze, and they made my aunt, she made my aunt sit up and hold me all night long so I wouldn't freeze behind the stove, so I wouldn't freeze to death.
And he didn't. Tell me a little bit, do you know anything about how your family came to be in St. Joe?
Yes. My maternal grandfather came over here from Ohio, and I think probably to work for the railroad. My maternal grandmother, my paternal grandmother came from Germany when she was 16 years old. And she was from Bavaria, and she landed in the States. And I think probably she had relatives living across the river or in Kansas. So how she got here, I don't know. The name was Bauer. And my grandmother's name was Lydia Barr. And the Barrs were big farmers over in Kansas. And I think she probably came over to live with them. My maternal grandmother was born in St. Joseph. And her father had a big farm up here. And my great-grandmother. And my great-grandparents, he had a big farm up here. His name was Morris. And he had some slaves. And my maternal grandmother, my mother was born in St. Joseph, essentially in St. Joseph. And my mother was born in St. Joseph. And my father was born in St. Joseph. And I never saw my father. He passed away in September, and I wasn't born until February.
He was in the Army.
And so I'm sure he was born in St. Joseph, as well as my mother.
Did he serve in World War One?
World War One. My father served in World War One, and he was in the artillery over at Fort Riley, which is now Junction City. And he was in the field artillery, and he was injured. They were fighting a brush fire, and he jumped on the caisson, which pulls the cannon, loaded with shells. He jumped on the caisson to put out the fire, and he sat down on a stud bolt sticking up like that, and right on his tailbone. And he, of course, he was infected, and he never fully recovered, and he died in 1920.
I have pictures of him and
AJ. He was 25 years old, 26 years old.
Which is why your grandmother was so protective of you.
Yeah. That's and my mother lived with my father. And they, the Barrs and the Myerses, they had a house, built a house on Seneca Street. And my mother lived with them, my father died. And so my grandmother was essential. I don't remember my grandmother, unfortunately, but she was a German lady. And I think what she said went in that household.
She lived in her pictures.
And she took care of me when I was 2 years old. When I was 2 years old, so I'm told, I had pneumonia fever. And I had learned to crawl and to walk. But when I recovered from the fever, I had to learn all over again. So they were very careful of me, because I was the first grandchild in the family.
Didn't they march you out and make you sit in the snow? There was one time you had pneumonia and they made you go sit in the snow for so long. And
no, that was on down the line.
Oh, okay. Not when you were two.
And what do I remember, first remember?
Yeah, what was your first memory?
My first memories were, I had three first memories. One I won't talk about. One I had, after my fever, my mother was very cautious, and they lived on a farm out off Woodbine Road. And there was a creek running down through the cow lot. And my mother told me, and I was about 3 years old, I remember this. She dressed me up warmly, and the doctor told her to let me be outside the portion of the day. Well, this was a sunny day in February, and she dressed me all up, and I went outside, and I was playing down, and I got down on the cow lot. I wasn't supposed to be, but I did. I got out on the cow lot, and there's a little stream running through it, and it was iced over. And I was playing around, and finally I got a rock, and I broke the ice in the pond and in the stream. And I took my shoes and socks off and rolled up my pants and went in waiting.
Oh, no.
And my mother looked out the door and saw me down in the cow lot waiting in the creek. And she let out a yell and ran down and grabbed me, took me up to the house and called the doctor right away. And he came out and checked me over, and he said, oh, there's nothing to worry about. That's my first remembrance. My second is, after that,
and there's
I decided to barber myself.
Oh.
And,
to what?
Yeah, I climbed under the chair, in a big rocking chair, in the living room out on the farm. This one I was about between 3 and 4. And I got the scissors, mom's scissors, and I took my hair and went.
Every kid.
And I thought I'd probably done something. Thought I'd done something wrong with immediately. But I climbed out, and mother said, "What did you do with your hair?" I went to the barber. I played barber under the chair. And she said, "Well, young man, I'm going to straighten your hair." Oh, it was terrible. And she said, "Young man, I'm going to straighten your hair out just a little bit. And you're going to wear that until your hair grows out. And I can take you to the barber and he can work on you." So I had a little hat. And my little hat was a little sailor's cap. And I took that little cap and I put it on and I wore that little cap from the time I got up till I went to bed. Because I was ashamed of myself for having, doing that little stunt. That's the second thing I remember. And I was 2 years old, and my father had been dead for 2 years, so 2.5 years. And my uncle Elmer, his brother, was the eldest in the family, and my mother married my uncle when I was about 2.5 years old, 3 years old. And so so I had an uncle for a stepdad. And so all my brothers and sisters were half brothers and sisters. And that's how that happened. So go ahead with your question.
You said, what street did you live on, you said?
What
street did you live on?
Seneca Street.
Seneca Street. And what was your house like? What was your street like growing up?
It was at that time, it was paved street. It was a paved street, and the house had, they hadn't ran the sewer, they didn't run the sewer out there at that time. And it had a two-hole out and back, and I had a four-room house. It was still a room in the attic. And it was a fairly nice house at the time. It was built, my uncle had it built. dealer had built. And so my mother stayed with my paternal family. I never lived with my maternal grandmother and father. So most of the things I'll talk about will be the Myers family.
How many people lived in that house? How many people lived in that house, Dad?
My grandma and grandpa and my uncle and Mama, my mom and myself.
So
and
you're
grandpa.
Calling Elmer your uncle at this time?
Yeah.
Or is that Uncle Taylor?
He was upstairs. He went upstairs. He had a bedroom upstairs.
Okay.
He worked at Swifting Company, and at that time he had a very good job because they hadn't learned how to make Crisco yet, or the what am I trying to say? They used lard. People used lard to cook with, and he was a tanker. He down at Swifting Company, he was in charge of tanking, and they had big vats like this room, and they threw all the fat in it, and they put steam around it and melt it, and that would make art out of it, and his job was to see that it was the lard was made and taken out, and then they steamed out the vat. And that was his job.
Wow.
And that was your stepfather?
That was my uncle. Very, very close to me.
Dad, was Taylor one of the brothers? Was Taylor Earl and Elmer's brother?
Taylor was... I never knew. My Uncle Taylor was my dad's brother and my stepfather's brother.
But they hadn't married Elmer yet. You were just living there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Yep. Okay. So tell me your parent, your biological father and your mother's name.
My biological father was Earl Rader Myers, and I was named after him. And where the Rader came from, my grandma and her friends had a deal where they named their children's their middle name was the friend's last name, and my name was Rader, and the Rader family lived over in Kansas, and there's still Raiders around.
Well, Quinn's a Rader.
Yeah.
My grandson's a Rader.
And my father, she knew a St. Clair, Mrs. St. Clair, so my stepdad's name was Elmer St. Clair, and my Uncle Taylor's name was... She knew a family named DeLoss, so Uncle Taylor got stuck with the middle name DeLoss. And my stepbrother, my younger stepbrother, was Elmer St. Clair, and I was Earl Rader.
So was Elmer the one that worked at the factory?
No, my uncle, that was my uncle.
Okay.
My stepdad, he worked at Quaker Oats, but Quaker Oats at that time was down. There was a mill down on Second and Edmund Street, and he worked down at the mill. And he was a very common man. He worked in the maintenance crew, and his job was to oil the machinery and see that it ran. Oil and grease and machinery. That was my stepdad's job. And he came home one night, and it's just, I'm talking about Depression now. This was the beginning of the Depression. The Great Depression. And he came home one night and looked down in the mouth, and Mother said, Elmer, what's wrong? He said, well, I was terminated today. And she said, well, I can't believe it. He said, everybody, word came down from Chicago that everybody over 40 years old was, we didn't want them on the workforce. And he was 50-some. And he was just automatically terminated. That was the way it was back in 1920. The laborers had very little say-so in their habits.
Then what did he do? Is that when he walked over to Kansas every day to go to work? Is that when he walked over to Kansas
yeah.
every day?
Yeah, he was, and I'm telling you just can't believe it. You just can't believe it in this day and age. I can remember when I was in grade school, my stepdad, would walk over to Kansas every morning around Wasena, around past Wasena, to go to work, to pick strawberries or raspberries or work on a farm. And that man did that every day. He'd get up in the morning early, 4:30 or 5, and start walking. And he'd walk over to Wasena, which is a pretty good walk today. And he was a day laborer. And to keep our family fed.
Tell him what your mother did, and tell her what your mother did and who she did it for. Tell her what grandma did and who she did it for.
Oh, my mother? Mm-hmm. My mother's name was Julia. And this is Julia.
And we have another.
And her mother's name was, grandmother's name was Julia. So Julia's come down through my maternal side. Three generations. And my mother, to make a dollar or two, Chase Candy Company, Mrs. Chase, their home was up fairly close to you, and she would go clean their house a couple of times a week. And then the Toodles, she worked for the Toodles, and she'd clean their house. She did. Or she would take in laundry, and
She baked bread because she baked bread. Remember, she baked bread, and you had to deliver.
Oh yeah, I forgot. She was a wonderful baker. I mean, she could bake white bread it'd melt in your mouth with butter, and the people up on Lover's Lane, which was. During the Depression was way up here, and we were way down here. She'd bake white bread. She'd bake bread two or three times a week. And my dad would take it up on Lover's Lane and deliver it. Families up there liked their bread so much. So good. It was so good that she made a few dollars baking bread. But back in those days, you'd do anything to make a dollar. And the people's work ethics. The people's work ethics were so good back in those days because they had jobs, good jobs, and suddenly they were out of work. And they'd just do anything to make a dollar. And the relief hadn't started yet. There was no relief. I mean, you either Ruth Ogden died, so to speak. And so I came from a very poor family.
I speak for my mother on this one.
We moved quite frequently because the landlords, you would live in a house so you couldn't pay your rent anymore, and then you were out. Then you found another house, and you lived in that house so you couldn't pay your rent anymore. And that was the way people lived back in those days.
Remember, you and Mom had some of your best arguments because Grandpa was a mail carrier, so Mom really didn't know. Mom was living in the end of town he's talking about. Not rich, but he always had a job, so Mom really never knew there was a depression. So the two of them would start bucking heads over. Dad would say, we were poor, just poor. Mom would go, oh, Earl, you were so poor. And yeah. They'd get into these things, and it would be so funny because they had the same age, the mm-hmm. same depression, but Mom wasn't particularly aware of the depression.
Yeah.
You said, because Grandpa always had a decent job.
Uh-huh.
He made bad business decisions, but you two used to spar quite a lot, that you came from nothing.
That's right. It was.
She'd be like.
It was rough.
Yeah.
And I know my mother and dad, who would have bacon and side meat, gravy and bread, and they would stand aside till we kids ate because they wanted us to have our dinner first, and if there's any left.
Dad, out of this is kind of interesting to kind of off thing. Tell her, out of all that depression and that lack of having anything, how successful their children were. Tell her what you did and your brothers. They had nothing, but tell her what they ended up being.
Oh, my mother, from the day I was born, and my older brother was born, my younger brother was next to me, second brother was born. She was determined. Now, she had an eighth grade education, which was a good education for her class. A good education, because they couldn't afford to go to college. And she had an eighth grade education, which was unusual for a lady in those, some ladies in those days. But she was determined that my brother and I was going to college, going to have a better education, and she had. So when we graduated from high school, I graduated from high school, she said, "Now, Earl, you can live here, and I'll feed you, and but I want you to enroll in junior college." So I went down and enrolled, and I had to pay for it out of my pocket. And so I finished. I went to junior college for 2 years and graduated, and then the war came along. And after the war, World War III, World War II, I got back to the States. So I went to, I had the GI Bill, which was a wonderful, I tell you, some of the people today, the GI Bill, they wouldn't have been able to go to college. They weren't able to go to college. And I was in the same boat. So I enrolled, I said, going to school. And Maryville was my first thought. And I said, well, I wanted to be an engineer. And so I wound up going to the University of Missouri, not the Columbia campus, but the Rolla campus, the Missouri School of Mines and Metallurgy, which is now the Missouri Institute of Science and Technology. I went to school there for 4 years and graduated. So I was graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering. And that was a pretty rough course.
Quickly tell her what Uncle Elmer ended up with.
And my uncle, my younger brother, he wanted to teach school. And so he went to Maryville and got his degree in teaching. And while he was teaching, he was pretty darn good. He was so smart that Lafayette High School, his name was on almost every science club. Every cup of school. And I'd meet people downtown after the war, and I'd say, "You're Elmer Myers. And you're up at, I remember you from Lafayette because you had your name on everything. You were the big shot up." And I just grinned and say, "Yeah."
You look like him.
It was, my brother and I resembled each other. And so down to the University of Missouri at Rolla. And, got his master's in mathematics, and he went to the University of Colorado at Boulder, and he got his doctorate in
applied
mathematics. And they told him the Bureau of Standards moved out to Colorado at Boulder, and they told him that when he graduated, that he could come across the street and work and stay over the Boulder to the university and pursue his education. Well, he had decided he had gone to school long enough. He was a doctor. And so he was a teacher, basically a teacher.
Principal at Hannibal High.
And he came back and taught at, he took the campus at Hannibal, Missouri High School. And he taught there for 15, 20 years, I suppose, so he retired. And then he would go to a community college and teach their math. And so we did.
Yeah, they all succeeded except for
girls. And the war came along, and my other brother and sister, Catherine and Bob, they never finished high school.
But Bob went on with the railroad and got successful.
He went to work for the railroad, and he had a very excellent job, because he said, "Earl, He said, this book, if I know this book by heart, I got it made. And he was finally the yard master at the Chicago yard, at rail yard. And my sister, she was married, she was a housewife. But I went back up to Lafayette after the war, and I talked to D.H. Murphy, Dr. Murphy. He was the principal before I left as principal. And he said, Earl, you wouldn't realize, you wouldn't believe your generation from the younger generation. They didn't care about, they just wouldn't get out of high school or quit high school just like during the war years. And that's the way it was. My mother was determined that we were going to college, my brother and I. Of course, the war hadn't started yet, and we did.
I heard that you went on some pretty exciting adventures when you were young, when you were a kid.
When I was a kid?
You were looking for Jesse James's.
Oh, I remember. We boys would, four or five of us were buddies, and 8 to 12 years old. And we played up on Billy Goat Hill. We lived on Grand Avenue, and Mom would turn us out and say, be here for lunch or be here at 2 o'clock. And we'd take off, and she wouldn't know where we were until 2 o'clock. But she never worried about us because kids just didn't get in trouble. So we decided, we heard that there was a cave up on off of Billy Goat Hill, that big, it's Wyeth Hill now. When I was a kid, it was Billy Goat Hill. And I think it got the name Billy Goat because some old character had some goats up on that hill one time. They called it Billy Goat Hill. But I'm not sure of that. That was a rumor. But we heard that there was a cave down on the face of the hill. And we talked about it, and kids didn't told us about it, they didn't know anything about it. So four of us one day, we decided we were going to find that cave. And by golly, we had to use ropes to keep from falling off the face of the hill. But we found that, we found the opening, and we stopped there and went in, and sure enough, it was a cave. And it was, and I say, the entrance was probably, 5 feet high, no more than that, five feet diameter. And we climbed in there, and sure enough, there was a cave. And we had candles, so we had candles. And we figured we'd have to have candles in a cave. And we had candles, and people had lived in there. Sometime prior to 1920, maybe after the Civil War, maybe deserters would live in that cave, I don't know. But they had cooking pits, fire pits, and we looked all around that cave. And I began to get just a little bit worried about that doggone cave. And so I said, I'm getting out of here. And we all got out, never went back. But to this day, when my boys, my grandchildren go up, say, don't climb in the cave.
Okay, we're on back roads.
Never do this, because I was thinking about if that opening had caved in while we boys were in there, they would never have found us. Never have found us. Because we never told anybody where we were going. And but we came out of that cave. And I never told my parents about that until I was growing. And all my grandkids, I go, said, don't go in a cave, because the entrance might cave in while you're in there. And we were out fishing one time, young man named Carl Webster, we were good buddies. And we went fishing up at the airport, and we were coming back up. There was a creek led into the Missouri River at that time. And we were fishing down close to the mouth of the creek, and we were coming up to the airport to ride our bikes back into town. And there's a man fishing up there too, up upstream from us. And he said, you boys go to the airport and call the police, have them call the police and the doctor, because I see a little boy in the creek, drowned. And he was bobbing along. And he didn't want us to see the sight. So we went to the airport and called the, had the airport manager call the police and the ambulance, and they came out. And this little boy, of course, he had drowned. But they have no idea what his name was. But the crux of my story is, a detective came up and knocked on my parents' door and said, do you have a boy named Earl Myers? Yes. My mother said, we do have. And he was on it, yeah. Well, there was a boy drowned out of it. And my mother just about died. She thought it was me. And the detective, oh no, you know, he corrected himself real. He realized that he did the boo-boo. And, but.
I don't know how Grandma didn't just die when she was about 40.
The airport manager, that day, name was Tommy Ogle, and Tommy had a yellow two-wing biplane, Carl knew him pretty well. He hung around the airport a lot, and for $15 a piece, he would take us up in that whole airplane, and so we saved our money, and we each had $15. We went out and gave Tommy $30. And we got in the front cockpit, and he got in the back cockpit, and he revved it up, and he gave us a ride over to St. We were, that was a thrill. That was a,
how old were you?
That was an adventure, that was a thrill.
How old were you when you did that?
About 12 or 13.
How ever did you save up $15?
We carried papers.
Oh.
We carried the Kansas City Star in high school, 13, maybe 14. We carried the Kansas City Star in the morning, Kansas City Times. It was a morning paper. And we get up at 4:30 or 5 and go down and get that paper and carry that stupid paper. And it was heavy. And we get a part of the, you know, when they collected, like carrying the news press.
Yeah, I know you.
And that's how we saved our money.
Okay, but, wow, there's some stories.
Did you tell your mother that you went up in the plane?
Oh, yes. I told her about that. I was very excited about that. And we went up in the plane, and he did a little, you know, bounced it around a little bit for us. And we thought that was fun. But that was three adventures I had growing up.
Quite the adventures. Now, what was it about, you said Jesse James. And
well, they thought they were going to find Jesse James' cave. That's what they were looking for. Jesse James' cave was what you were looking for. When you were going down Billy Goat Hill, that story was looking for Jesse James' cave.
It was rumored that Jesse James had a cave up there. And Jesse James' cave was never found. But we boys thought we thought it was Jesse James' cave. We really did think it was Jesse James' cave, because we didn't know any better. And we never told anybody about that trick either.
Boy.
Because
yeah,
I knew I'd be in serious trouble. But those are three adventures I had.
What school or schools did you attend when you were younger?
After World War II, the generation, it was pretty crowded when you were going to school, and probably you. Schools were crowded. But after World War I, they were really crowded, because the fellows in 1918 had come home and they'd start their families. And then in about 1926 or 5, kids would start school. And I was 6 years old. I started the school over at Lafayette. Lafayette was a grade school and a high school. And I started school over there, and I could only go a half day. In half day in the morning, half day or afternoon or morning, because the schools were so crowded that they didn't have trouble for we had our elementary school. And then after that, I went to the old.
Did you go to Webster?
No, Wyatt School. Wyatt was at the Wyatt School. I don't remember. I can't remember offhand. I'll think about it. It's no longer there. It was torn down. It was up on Henry Street and 11th. And then from there I went to the Webster School.
Oh.
And then I went back to Lafayette again in ninth grade. And I graduated from Lafayette High School.
And then you already that was college. Yeah,
but it was they made a mistake. I was pretty good in school, and but they accepted math, and I was all right in math. I was keeping up with it, but in the fifth grade, I went for about 5 weeks A and B, fifth A, fifth B. I went to fifth A for about 6 weeks. And they decided I was smart enough to go to the 5th B. So they jumped me. They jumped me from the 5th A to the 5th B. And I kept up everything but math. And we were in short division in math in the 5th A. And they were in long division in 5th B. And I never could quite master that. I got along all right. I passed it. But from then, every grade on up, math was my problem.
Which you passed on.
And then in college, you had a lot of math. And my school experiences. I don't have any particular, except didn't skip the grade. And reading, I was a good reader. Oh, I could read well. And my dad could never figure it out how I could read so well. And he'd say, "What's that word?" And I wouldn't know it. And he'd say, "Straight to him and Antley. He doesn't know that word, but he can read the whole sentence." Well, we learned to read in blocks at that time. And Dorothy Dubois, she died, 6 months ago maybe. I saw in the paper. She and I would get to stand up and read. And we shouldn't have been us standing up and reading. It should have been some kids down here who stood up and read. But that's either here or there.
And you got in trouble for teaching me and how to read wrong. In 1955, I was reading books.
Oh yeah, we were reading. We were reading about the Pilgrims.
Yeah.
And we had to read from page 27 to 30, quiet reading, silent reading, and we were reading along. Teacher tapped me on the shoulder and she says, "Earl, what page are you on?" I don't know. I looked up and it was page 50-something, for example. And she said, "I told you to stop reading at 30, and you're up to 50. How come?" Well, I was just reading so fast, and I was so interested in that book. So I read slower from then on, so I wouldn't be in trouble. That's neither here nor there. Oh. To this day, I remember there was a little teacher that taught biology, or what they called biology back in those days. And she talked about a fish, about an animal, not a fish, about an animal that lived in this ocean. It was a big animal. And I stuck up my hand and I said, "That was a whale." And she said, "What was it?" And I said, "A whale." She said, "What was it?" And I said, "A whale." She said, "No, it wasn't a whale, Earl. It was a whale." And you know, to that day, that's cool that I figured that teacher was one of my favorites. And from that day on, she embarrassed me, really embarrassed me. She wanted a whale. And not a whale.
That's why you're the greatest generation. You had those good teachers.
Yeah. You said you were about 9 years old when the Depression hit.
Well,
you were about 9 years old when the Depression hit then.
Oh, I was about Yeah, it was about 1928, 29.
How did you, from your perspective as a child, how did you see things change?
Oh. It was 99 degrees different. If you didn't have a job, you didn't go down and apply for work, you know, whatever the work is, and get paid while you're waiting for the job. That didn't happen. As far as the schools are concerned, I think they might have been a little better back in those days. We were taught. For those who wanted to learn, could learn.
When you were first with Elmer, your first memories of having lots of food and all that kind of stuff, when did you notice that you were suddenly very poor? When did you notice you went from being comfortable to being poor? Because you were poor.
We were comfortable. We didn't know we were poor because everybody else was poor. I mean, it was a depression. Nobody was working. And if you lived on Elmer's Lane, you were cut above us. And I had friends. Well, my friends were here, not here. And we lived on the lower end and the upper end. But we had friends down on the lower end, so we really didn't realize how bad it was, because our folks didn't let us know.
Well, you talked about cardboard for your shoes. There were times your shoe soles were cardboard, is that correct?
Your dad would, when you wore a hole in your shoe, in the sole, my dad had a shoe last. He'd put a shoe on that last and take the old sole off and take a piece of leather and cut us a new piece and tack on, and we wore those shoes. I tell you, I was so sick of wearing a pair of shoes, I thought I'd die. I think my father put about three or four soles on those shoes and heels. And if you got a hole in your shoe, you put a piece of cardboard in it in the sole. You put a piece of cardboard in it till your parents could afford to take a shoe to the shoe doctor, to the shoe repair man, or the shoe repair business, that was a business now that you don't have anymore. And there was several shoe repair, and it was a respected business at that time. They'd have their shop, and everybody takes their shoes in to have half soles or heels put on. That was true. Did I go mope around in the depression? No, I didn't mope around. I had fun.
And you had a dime for movies. You went to your movies, though.
Over on St. Joe Avenue. St. Joseph Avenue now. There was a theater over there called the Rialto, run by Frank Bosco. And every week, every Saturday, Frank would have a Western movie and a cereal. And it was a nickel. And we would all, every Saturday, we'd live for Saturday, we'd go over and get in line, and he'd fill that theater up with kids for a nickel piece. I mean, there wouldn't be five adults in, and we'd get so excited, we'd yell and holler and stomp our feet, silent movies, stomp our feet and yell, scream, and Mr. Musco would stop the film and come out on in front of the screen and say, "Now you guys, I told you, no yelling or hollering or screaming, and you forgot. Now I'm going to start this movie again, maybe, and if I hear any more out of you, that'll be all for Saturday." So we'd calm down, we'd be calm down, and then we'd forget, and we'd start yelling again. And that was fun. That was really fun. And Mr. Mosco would come out, and this is the second time. There's no third time. Just, well, I'll stop it again. You realize the show's over for the day. And we'd be quiet for the rest of the movie. Oh, the kids don't realize today how much, what we did. And ball, we go out to, at that time in 1930, Dizzy Dean, the pitcher, he pitched for St. Joe. He came through St. Joe on his way up. And we go out to the Navajo gangs, and we go out to the ballpark, and they had a wood fence all around it. And we find you a Navajo, or cracking a fence, you could look through that and pretty well see the ball field. That's how we watched our ball games.
Sounds like a movie.
Those of us who were poor. It was fun. It was fun.
It sounds like
we made our fun. Our folks were so busy looking for work or working that we had to make our fun. And we go down on the boulevard by Corby Pond, and we'd fish for Caudette, and we'd roll up our pants, and you take a coffee can, punch holes in the bottom, and go to the store and buy a nickel's worth of liver, and get your liver and put in the coffee can, and you'd put your coffee can down in the bottom, and a crawdad would come up and grab it, and then you'd carefully raise the can up and throw your crawdad in a pot, and we'd catch a bunch of crawdads and come home, and my mother would make a fire in the backyard. And she had an old pot. And when the water got to boiling, we'd throw our crawdads in and cook them. And they were like a miniature lobster. And you can still buy crawdads, crayfish they call them at the store. You still buy them to this day. But that's how we had, that's one thing we did. And in the ball, we'd have a sock. We'd fill a sock full of rags and take a broomstick and go down the boulevard, and it'd be four on a team, eight of us. And we'd where there's a level space on the boulevard, we would team up and play sock ball. Oh, it'd take all morning to have a game of sock ball. But That's how we played. Never. And then we'd have to help. I'd have to help when I was 12 or 13. My mother, when she was working, my dad was gone, I'd be in charge of the household and have to make the beds and sweep the floor and then start dinner for her. That was the norm, not the exception. You'd have to peel the potatoes and get supper started for Mom. And that was that. Okay.
You told me a little bit about your childhood. What are some of your memories from when you were a teenager?
Oh, when I was a teenager.
Did you go to Lafayette, or did you go?
Yeah, we attended Lafayette, and Central was our bitter enemy. And it was Lafayette, Benton, Central, and Christian Brothers. Christian Brothers is a bond now. And it was a high school just for boys. And the girls went to the convent down on, across from where that $1 million house is now.
Oh, where the Weemses live?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know those streets very well.
But we go to football games, basketball games, and I couldn't go out for basketball or football because I worked. I had a job in the last year of high school. There are some companies here, Light and Power Company, the Gas Service Company, the Water, three or four companies. They would hire a boy in high school to she gave him a few dollars. And the gentleman who was heading the program picked me out of Lafayette High School. And I went to work for the Lighting Power Company for a quarter of an hour, I think. And after so many hours, you got raised to 30 cents. Well, I was lucky, and I went to work for the Lighting Power in my senior year in high school. And I was put in the laboratory and washing bottles with clear water, condensate. And condensate, the steam that's been condensed into, you'd have to wash the bottles out so they'd be, you didn't want to get a boiler mixed up with something else, you know. And I was put to work washing bottles. And Mr. Harrison, he was the chief chemist at the time. And he mumbled. He was a great mumbler. And I just strained my ears to hear him talk, because I didn't want to be embarrassed by having to ask a lot of questions. But he would, I remember the gas calorimeter one time. He'd come back, he would re-run it every day, and he decided it was time for me to learn. So he got on it, and he would say, "Now you take this reading and multiply it for that reading." And I have a hard time understanding him. But I worked in the lab.
Did you have a car?
Didn't have a car.
Oh, I thought you had an old model.
I was up at Second Edmund Street, Third and Edmund Street. The lab was upstairs. The building is no longer there. In fact, the power plant's no longer there. There was a power plant that served St. Joseph. It was down on Second Edmund, Third and Edmund, and it was the St. Joseph Railway Light, Heat, and Power Company. And we had the streetcar service. And the steam heat, downtown was heated by steam. All the buildings were steam heated. But steam we furnished from the power company. And so I got to work down there, which was good, because I learned some chemistry. Water chemistry down there. And when I got through with high school, they said, "We're going to let you work. We're going to keep you. If you want to, we'll keep you on." And so I worked for them until I was through with junior college. Well, in fact, worked for them until I was in the Army. And worked for them all through junior college. And the steam plant down in South St. Joseph. It's, you see pictures of it now. That was a steam plant originally. Armors blew heck out of their boiler room one time. They had a gas explosion. And instead of rebuilding, they talked them into furnishing steam to Armor. So they built a plant down there. All they did was furnish steam. And I worked, and they transferred me down there. Mr. Harrison said, "Now I want you to go down there and you run these samples. And you tell me, call me and tell me what the results are." Or the chief engineer down there knew about it too. So I went down there, and I was going to school. They take samples at 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock a.m., say, and they'd save them, set them aside, and I'd come down at 2 o'clock and I'd analyze them. And that happened until I graduated from school, college, and that's another story. Then I worked down there till I was in the Army, firing the boilers. But in 1941, December 1941, the gang I was buddies with, six of us, eight of us, we were up at the school grounds and at an opportunity school. It's no longer there. We were playing touch football. And some guy drove up in his car and he got out and he said, Pearl Harbor, do you know where Pearl Harbor is? He had no idea where Pearl Harbor. Well, the Japanese, I've been in reports, that the Japanese just bombed Pearl Harbor. And that, that was a shock. I had a date with my wife that night. We weren't married. But it was still up in the air. You know, we didn't have any idea where Pearl Harbor was or what it was all about. And the Japanese had bombed it without warning. And years later, they found out that their ambassador was supposed to go up and tell the president that they considered themselves at war with the United States, but he was late getting there. So they bombed it without us knowing it.
That day your life changed.
Yeah. And we set, and I was going to junior college at that time. I was just ready to graduate. And Nellie, Mrs. Bloom, who was the dean of the school, you've read about her in the paper, she called the convocation for like 10 o'clock in the morning. The students, we all went to the auditorium, and she had a radio, and we heard the president declare war on Japan and Germany. And when I sat there, I thought, boy, your life has changed this minute. Your life has changed. I'll never be the same. Never be the same. And it wasn't the same. And so I decided, we were too young to sign up for the first draft, but the second draft caught me just right smack in the middle. And I was called to the Army in June 1942. And I served till March 1946. And I was the first lieutenant when I graduated, well, at the end of the war, in the Corps of Engineers.
Weren't you the youngest?
Yeah, I was. I was so young that I was only 22, and I got drafted over at Fort Leavenworth. And they did our IQs, and the sergeant said, doesn't matter, doesn't mean a thing. It's just you know, if you don't do well,
you'll be good anyway.
And I thought to myself, they don't give you these tests unless it means something. So I did as well as I could. But anyways, we got on the train. We were assigned out units for basic training. And we rode, and we rode, and we rode all night long, and all morning long, and in the afternoon, the train pulled in Rolla, Missouri, of all places. And we went out to
Leonard Wood? Leonard Wood? Wasn't it Fort Leonard Wood?
Fort Leonard Wood. Went out to Fort Leonard Wood. And it was, at that time, it was an engineer's training center. And I took I took 8 weeks of basic training in the they all got assigned someplace else, and I was picked to stay there. To it made a corporal at that time, and I stayed there in cadre. That's so the next group of people through. So I was there all summer long, and then they posted a notice that at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, the engineer school was accepting candidates at OCS, Officer Candidate School. And I went up and took a test, and there was a colonel and a major and a captain in the board, like this room here. And I I sat there and they asked me questions. And the colonel said, Corporal, you're very young. And the engineers, mostly older men, he said, how would you handle it? Well, I say older men, 35-year-old man, or 40-year-old man. I said, just like I'm sitting here talking to you now, I mean, it wouldn't affect me one way or the other. Then a major went up to a blackboard, and he drew a right triangle. And he said, now, Corporal, he said, can you tell me the sign of that angle, the sign of this angle? And I whipped it out. I just had trig. I just finished trig. And he said, that'll be all. And he went, and it was posted that I was going to OCF from our company, from our group. So I went back to Fort Belvoir in Virginia. And we did field ops on Washington's lawn, some of them. And I was there for 9-10 weeks. And on November the 5th, 1942, November the 11th, 1942, which was Armistice Day then, I got my commission of second lieutenant in the U.S. Army.
Boy, you cut a dashing figure. I should give you that picture.
That happened really fast. I went in June and then a private, and then in November I was a second lieutenant.
And then what happened?
Pardon?
Then what happened a week later?
And then 2 weeks later, we had a delay en route, and I came back to a 10-day delay en route. I came back to St. Joseph. And Arlene Silverthorne and I were married.
November 17th.
And we got on the train. Oh, can you imagine? We would try to talk him out of it today, I'm sure. She was 19, and I was 21. And we were coming up to our birthdays at 22 and 20. And, or 21 and 20. And, or 22 and 20. And, we got on a train to Washington, set from St. Louis, St. Joe to Kansas City, Kansas City to St. Louis, and St. Louis to Washington, and Washington to Melbourne, down North Carolina. And what am I trying to say the name of the town was?
Well, you went to Fredericksburg, I thought, for a while, and then you went to North Carolina?
Yeah.
Where Duke University is?
We went to North Carolina from St. Joseph.
Oh.
Uh-huh. Durham, North Carolina.
Yeah, Durham.
We got off the train, had to take a taxi cab to Durham, North Carolina. And the George Washington Duke Hotel was the fanciest hotel. Everything in North Carolina up in that area was Duke. George Washington Duke. It's tobacco. And we stayed at that hotel. We could get in that hotel, but we had to be out the next day.
Well,
Duke had a big football game that weekend, and it was the hotel was booked solid. So I got up about 4 o'clock in the morning, got the paper, and looked at the apartments for rent. And they were very, very few and far between. And I saw this apartment for rent out on, I don't know, remember the name of the street, but it was, got on the bus and went out there, and they had a bedroom, they converted a bedroom and their back porch into a bedroom or the living room and a bedroom, and they had a little kitchen out there, and we shared the bath, and they said, yeah, it was just that very day they put it in the paper for rent. So we took it. I took it. And we lived out there. Well, I was fortunate. I didn't worry so much about Arlene because he was a patrolman. And he was on the police force. And we lived out there while I was at, while I took a group through basic training. and water supply. He said, when you finished, I'll tell you how it was back in those days. When you finished OCS, when you were assigned to a unit, they asked you if you had any objection to if it was black or not, because they segregated the troops. I said, I didn't have any objection to that. Well, I'd like to have a water supply unit. Well, they got the water supply unit. I got into Durham, North Carolina, went out to Camp Butner, and there was there were black troops washing down the units and water supply units, and I thought, boy, this is something else. And I went in to report in, and there was a big black first sergeant. And this is the first time I knew I was assigned to black troops. And I didn't mind it. It was, you know, it was a time when white officers, if they objected to going, they didn't take them. Well, I didn't have any trouble with the black people at all. We went to, I had a black water supply group, platoon. And the commanding officer of our water supply battalion was a colonel, full colonel, wing colonel, chicken colonel, we called him. He told us the night before, they had the core after 12 weeks they inspected the unit, the battalion, to see if it was combat ready, and our colonel at that time didn't like black troops at all, didn't want them, and he called it had an officer's call that night, and he called the officers in from the battalion, said, I don't want these boys to pass tomorrow. I don't want them to pass. So I put it down, had a company called all the guys out. I said, no, if you don't do good tomorrow, I'm going to be on your rear ends, so you won't like it. If you don't pass it, you do good. And they did everything but camouflage. And at the officers called the next day, the units that were, how the units did, they were the only black unit. We were the only black unit that was in this group. And our colonel stood up and said, now you see how bad these black boys did today. And this is just typical of the training. And the colonel, this colonel said, Colonel, he said, your black boys did better than most of the white troops in the corps, in the group. So sit down. That's one time we all went against the colonel. The idea, because he would say, well, if they had proper training, they would have passed it.
And they did have proper training.
Yeah, and made the training officers look bad. But I had absolutely, well, I'll tell you, back in Durham, North Carolina, this was an adventure. Ollie and I was on a bus coming home one night she met me downtown for some reason. We took a bus home. And it was crowded, and back they had, at that time, the back of the bus was for black people, and the front of the bus was for white people. And this black private got on the bus, a little black private, and he went back to where he was supposed to go and sat down in the black section. And there was a white sergeant got on the bus. And he walked back and he told this black kid to get up. to get up that he wanted his seat. I tell you, I was just, you talk about getting twice mad. I don't do it very often. But I mean, I got furious. And Arlene said, sit down. I said, I can't. I got up. I said, Sergeant, you get up and give that boy back his seat. And you stand up here with the rest of us. Well, he did. And boy, you could drop the pin on that bus and inherit it. Because it was nearly 80% white and 20% black. And I got off the bus and I never realized what I was doing until it was over.
Mom was mad at you at that till she died.
She was so mad at me for...
She was just
amazing. Yeah, I was furious. I was furious that that white sergeant would have the gall to tell that black boy to get up. And so that's how I hated the black troops. And we'd have to get them together, get the platoons together so often and have our companies together and have an orientation, you know, talk about things in the States. And my black troops would always say, Lieutenant Myers, we want Lieutenant Myers to give this. Because, even they were just like me. They weren't any better or any worse than I was. Oh, their education was worse. Because they didn't have education.
Didn't you say you got them to march? That they were, you marched and you knew they were dancing well, and so you got them to do cadence, and they were the sharpest unit in the parade. Didn't you tell me that? I don't think I dreamed that. You realized how good they were at marching.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. In the parade, they were...
I had a platoon, a crack platoon, and they were good. I mean, I'll say this, the black soldiers had a rhythm that couldn't be beat. And I'd get into that rhythm and give orders, and they'd just swing into it, you know. And we were good, we were pretty good. But then I got overseas and I got over in to North Africa. And after combat for a year with the 120th Engineers, I had a Jeep accident and ruined my shoulder and I was reassigned. I wasn't fit for combat, but I was in combat for 6 months before they got around to doing it. I had a friend in the States, a captain, and he was with black troops here over here. And he came down to the record, to the center when they sent all of us people who were for reassignment. And some of those guys that sit there for months waiting to be assigned. And I was there about 2 days, and the lieutenant come up to headquarters. Come up to headquarters and said, how would you like to be? Well, I could go with the 92nd Engineers. And I said, that's fine. Well, this captain I knew back at Durham, he came out. He said, Myers, he said, haven't seen you for a long time. And he said, I'm up with the 92nd. He said, we'll go up tonight. We had his Jeep. So we got in the Jeep, and it was up in Leghorn, Italy. And just before we turned into the unit, I said, Frank, you're not telling me something. And he grinned. He has another black unit. I didn't care. It didn't bother me too much. But my time spent with the 120th Combat Engineers was very interesting. They landed just before I did in North Africa. And I was assigned to them. When I was in North Africa, I was assigned to a base hospital, the VAC hospital, in their service headquarters. The lights and water and what have you. Two of us, two officers, this captain and I. And I had to supply water for 21,000 enemy troops that had been captured in North Africa. And
Germans, primarily?
Yeah, the Africa Corps.
Yeah. Oh, Rommel.
That was the elite German units. And in North Africa, Hitler pulled out and just left them. And they were captured. And we had 21,000 in our camp. And had to supply water for them. And then I went up to Sicily, and was there for just a short time. It was 120th Engineers Combat, and then we on the invasion of Italy. I was in on that, and we were picked to go up to Anzio. I was up at Anzio for 6 months, and that was rough. And then I went to questions?
Oh, all right. You told me some memories about the war. Do you have any other memories about when you were in the service that you want to share?
I had a corporal. I was in the Mediterranean Theater. I never got up to Europe at all. I was in the Mediterranean Theater of Operations. And then Italy was included in that. And we were in Italy for, seemed like 10 years.
It was very wet, very muddy.
I had a corporal. He was a first generation Italian in the States. And he could speak Italian fluently. And he was a corporal in the Army, in the Corps. And I had a Jeep, and I had my sergeant, and had him in the Jeep all the time, because I could take him all around, and he could translate for me. And one time, they were having a firefight in this little town, and we got up in this little town, and there was a fire, and you could hear the all the commotion going on, and I was looking around for a water point, because I had 21,000 members of the 45th Division of the 120th Engineers, and we had to take care of our infantry. We took care of our regiment, and it was about 9,000, 10,000, and I was going up, walking up the street, up a little hill, and there was a lot of fences over in Italy. And people with their property, they'd mark it with fences. And this was a high fence, masonry. And my sergeant and I was walking up the sidewalk, and suddenly it sounded like I thought we were being driven down in the dirt, and come to find out, we picked ourselves up and looked all around, and in fact, the wall was still there, and no sign of destruction except two ignorant people squatting on the ground. And pretty soon it happened again, and there's tank destroyers behind the fence, but we didn't see them, and they didn't see us. And right when we got to where they were, they fired over our heads. Hit German tanks the place up the road. But we got to looking around this little town, and they said the Germans had poisoned the water well before they left, and it was a good well too. And I seriously doubted that, and they did. They do. And they brought up a bucket of water, and I took a drink of it. There's no poison in this well, I think you're imagining it. And but a fella came out, and he said, Tony said something to him, and He did. Uncle, my Tony, said, "Uncle, so, this is my uncle." And his family came from this little town, and he had his relation live there. And so Tony, his family, I gave him all the time off I could to be with his family. And they had us in frequently. In fact, they said, for 2 weeks. I said, "Tony, I don't see you for 2 weeks. You say I won't know where you are, but I don't care." So I gave him 2 weeks to visit his family. And they had us in for dinners, and beautiful dinners. And they had hidden stuff from the Germans. They'd pull a block out of a wall and pull a ham out, you know, something like that. And they took care of us real well. And I was sick. I must have had the flu. And this grandma, this Italian grandma, she said she had a chair with a seat cut out, like a potty seat. And she said, "I want you to sit on that." And she covered me all up with blankets. And then she put, it was a brazier she put under the chair. And she put charcoal under there.
Oh, she braised you.
Yeah, and she lit it. You know, I'm telling you, I was sweating like a crazy boy. She said, you sweat? And I did. And I probably felt better after that. But I got the treatment, I got the Italian treatment for the flu.
Is that where the lovely young woman was they thought maybe you should marry?
Hmm?
Is that the family that had the lovely daughter that...
Oh, no. It was one time, it was, I came in off a recon, and I happened to see the battalion surgeon. And he said, "Myers," he said, "I got a nice deal here." He said, "You're welcome to stay in the basement." And his family, they had a house, and he had set his headquarters up in this, our battalion surgeon's headquarters up in the basement. And we were, four or five of us, was celebrating New Year's Eve there with the colonel's medicinal liquor. He would have a bottle of liquor that they were issued, alcohol, medicinal alcohol. And we all had medicinal drinks that evening. And along about 11 o'clock, this Italian gentleman, he came down to our, "Oh, I got to have a doctor." He said, "I got to have a doctor." It was fortunately our battalion surgeon. And his wife was about to deliver. And he took a battalion surgeon up, and he delivered twins to this lady. And he came back, he said, "You'll never guess what they called them. Franklin and Eleanor." So there's an Italian family over there. There's Italians over there about my age now, but a little younger, named Franklin and Eleanor. Was delivered that night, New Year's Eve, in 1942 or 3.
Really, 1943. Well, one of them had a daughter. Mom's listened to these stories to the point where she couldn't stand them anymore, and she'd say, "Earl, just shut up, I can't take it." And you were telling the story one night, Chris was already, my oldest was already out of college, about a pretty young Italian, that woman. You were talking about not cheating on mom and how you stayed faithful, and but there was that beautiful young Italian woman, somebody wanted you to marry, or some father brought her out.
Oh, no. I was up in Leghorn. I had a week detached service with the British Army. I had a good friend in the British Army, and I got a week detached service to be with the British Army up in Genoa. And we're out in the base, woman, and this girl, she wanted to get married. She didn't give, I met her for about a day or 2 days. She wanted me to get married. And I said, and strictly to get to the States. And I said, well, I'm already married. That's one reason I can't take you. And we're leaving there pretty quick. I'm leaving there pretty quick. That's another reason I can't marry you. And the fact that I'm already married is difficult. And there was quite a few girls over there who would marry GIs just to get to the States.
But he told that story, and we were all eating. And my oldest son looked at him like, Grandpa. You know, they weren't hearing the side of the grandfather before. And my mother stopped eating, and she goes, well, I've never heard that story before. She was really irritated.
Yeah, well, when I got back, I finally told her, I never heard that story before.
That one after 60 years.
And there was a banker's daughter. They had a villa up in the hills.
That's the one.
And she was a beautiful girl, beautiful girl. Olive skin, typical Italian, gray eyes. And she said, my parents are going to be up the villa for this weekend. You can come up and spend it at our place. Well, I had to say no.
That's the one, because he went into such a description of how her beauty was. And that's when Chris went, Grandpa? I was like,
but we were at Anzio, and that was a pretty bad deal. You see, the American Army never wanted to be in Italy, and Churchill insisted that we could go. D-Day would be in the south of France instead of on Normandy. So they traded that we would participate in Italy, and if they would go ahead and invade up there. And our army there never was really, we felt like second cousins, really. Because England was getting everything for the invasion, and all of our jeeps would, we'd have some jeeps, new jeeps, and they'd take them away from us. Give them all wore out stuff, and so we were kind of second cousins to the boys up in England. But that's some adventures I had.
Yeah, those are the good ones. Those are the ones you always tell.
When we up in Anzio, a colonel wanted to know what the Germans are doing up there at night. Well, there's a stream went from around the Arsac, went from Anzio, flowed down and around and into the Mediterranean, and we found this creek. It was empty, and we decided it'd be a pretty good place to do a water point if we ever got there. And so it was sort of the dividing line between the Germans and the Americans, or British troops. And we got in this creek and went around it, and you can see where the Germans had come up and leave their weapons at night and then pull back in the daytime. There was the British, and they had holes dug in the bank to get into in case of shelling. And we got around almost in the British sector, and I saw a pair of legs sticking out of a hole. And the British and the Germans, they wore shorts. And I wish the Americans could have. And I almost, that Englishman come out of that hole and he's looking right down the barrel of a .45. I had my gun out. It looked like a German, and I was going to, he's looking right down the barrel of a .45.
What'd he say?
Pistol.
What'd he say? I love Churchill?
Quickly. Yeah, I'm English. Yeah. So, that, but I did have a German one that did, up at Anzio, up by Rome. We were sitting down there by a stream, and I don't know what we were doing, just sitting there, and we weren't told what we were doing. And I looked down in the bushes, and I could see a uniform. It didn't look exactly like ours, but didn't. I kept watching it. And here come a German up out of the bushes. And he had enough war. He was ready to quit. And he came up to me and said, you know, all the signs of he didn't have a, he wasn't armed or had his, but he wanted to surrender. And I didn't have time to take that kid back to the MP post. So I told him, get on back, go back there.
Go surrender.
That was my claim to fame. I captured a German.
You captured a German, and he probably had a family, and they're all nice.
That was something funny that happened. You don't remember the bad things. Yeah.
He had some people.
You talk to the veterans, they don't tell you sad stories.
You had some PTSD, though, because when you got back after school, you had that nervous breakdown in Texas, remember? And that's when you started embroidery. The doctor said, I can give you Quaaludes or you can find a hobby. Mom said, she was pregnant with me, and you came back from the war with some...
Oh, yeah. We had one of our guys, though. There's a little fella. We couldn't... He was just a little... just. Common, ordinary GI, private, and he cook. And he came out one morning and couldn't find him. And pretty soon one of our guys came back and said, I think you better go back and about 15 yards in the brush and look and take a look. And he's back there, and he cut his throat.
Oh,
yeah. He cut his throat with a dull knife, nicked in it from here to here. He never knew why he cut his throat, but he did. So you never know when somebody's had it enough. But that was a bad thing.
Can you tell me what St. Joe was like for you coming back from the war?
Yeah, I came back on a hospital ship. We landed in South Carolina in Charleston Harbor. This was exciting from there, the middle of the state. And when we were coming back in, we could see some green and red far out in the water, and it looked so good to us. It looked so good to us that all the roofs of the houses in Italy and North Africa were mostly slate color, and the roofs on the houses. And we got back to the States on VJ night evening. The Japs had just surrendered. Well, we got in, and it was assigned quarters. And we went up to the Oak Club, Officers Club, and to have dinner. And the sergeants in charge of the Oak Club came up with a box of cigars. They said, I want you gentlemen to have a cigar on the house, because the Japs are just about to surrender. And that was the best news we had heard. They dropped the A-bomb.
How long before you got back to St. Joe? Mom joined you. There's kind of a jog.
Oh, it was
Mom
just...
Mom joined you, and then you took your little trip to New York City, and you were speeding back to St. Joe real early. How long was it between when you Mom joined you, and then you and she drove back here? There was quite a space, because you went to New York and took your... So you weren't back here until about 19.
I was back in North Carolina for about 4 or 5 days, and assigned to another unit, an automatic 10-day delay en route, and so I got on a train Oh, no. Scratch that. We got on a train in Charleston and came back to Kansas City. And your mother met me at Kansas City. Well, my cousin Ellen and Hank met me, and she came down to their house. And then we came on home.
So you left here and did the honeymoon because you
don't have to
live with them. So when you got here, that's when Grandma wasn't so very nice on the porch.
She wasn't very nice.
And then you all lived here for a while when you came back to St. Joe. Where'd you stay? With Mom, with Grandma and Grandpa Silver?
Yeah, it was just, that was in, like in August. And I started school the next, August. But I had 6 weeks to lay in. I had six weeks leave. I never had a leave from the time I left the States till I came back to the States. And 30 days a year you have.
When you got back here for that 6 weeks you laid around, how was it different here than when you left? How was it different in that 6 weeks? The town itself, the people, was there much difference?
Oh yeah, it was... When you got back to the States, well, we were slated to go to Japan, or slated to go to the, over for the Japanese invasion. That's what they're building up for. But the Japs surrendered, so that would scratch that. And we got back to St. Joe, July. I don't know if I work for the company again or not.
Well, you were just here for a few weeks, weren't you? And then you went down to Ross.
So yeah, I went to school. Then I went to school.
Yeah, so when you got here, what was the first thing you noticed was different in St. Joe than when you left? Like a change, like Jesus.
Oh, yeah. Well, I told you some of the change in school. And St. Joe was still St. Joe.
It still is. You didn't notice anything different?
Nothing during happened during the war years. St. Joseph, I remember St. Joseph. There's something to question about St. Joseph.
Just about how it was different when you came back from the war.
Change, really?
The Madison Fenton and Nadine Medicines were my good friends. They were our good friends forever, practically.
They were just in the paper. They died together. Those friends. So you went to college. You went to college. And then you went to Texas and had me. And Mom said, Mom was Mom, I've been through the war with you. I've been through college with you. But I will not live in Texas anymore.
Yeah.
Because
oh,
yeah. They lived out in the West.
When I graduated from college, at that time they were grabbing engineers. And there's a company in Oklahoma that was doing, they were making sodium sulfate down in Texas. And Bill Coghill, who was the superintendent of the plant and related to the owner, he came up to Rolla to look for an engineer, and we hooked up. And I went to work for Ozark Chemical Company in Monahans, Texas. And Monahans, Texas is, well, pretty close. You heard of Judge Bean down on the... it was about 40. It was out in West Texas, really out in West Texas. And arid and dry and hot, sandstorms.
Tarantulas and, migrated through there.
And Arlene, I took Arlene's, we had a fairly nice house too. We had a tourist cabin. Then we found this fairly nice house, snake proof.
If you knew my mother, then.
Coyote proof, and had a fence around it, and we lived there. But I'm telling you, sandstorms, we people in this in this country doesn't know what a sandstorm is. I mean, they had sandstorms. My wife would spend all her time running from the back door to the front door in this sandstorm-proof house, sweeping up sand. Yeah.
Pregnant.
It was another experience out there. Square dance. Those people square danced. We got acquainted to square dancing out there. And finally, I got to be president of the club, and Shell Oil Company had a 1 million gallon tank. And that was a big tank. It leaked, the bottom would leak after they got the whole thing built. And filled it with oil, the bottom was leaking. So they drained the tank, cleaned it out, and there it sat. And we'd have square dances in this tank. Yeah. And broadcast. It'd be broadcast. All through West Texas. Every station to pick it up. And but we square danced out there. Had some good friends in West Texas. Went to church. Dewey was born there.
Until the scorpion dropped out of my blanket. Mom said, Earl, you find another job now.
Yeah.
And so then you moved back here and went back to the Lightning Power.
But we came up here for Christmas. And I took some vacation. And Ernest Harrison, who he was the vice president but at this time, and in charge of operations. And I visited Ernie, and he said, Earl, he said, what are you doing down in Texas? He said, well, why don't you come up here? Why don't you come back to St. Joe? And I said, well, there's no work up here. I got plenty of work for you. So I went to work for the St. Joe's Flood and Power Company in 1950. And I went back down and I told Bill Cogg, I said, we're leaving your company and going up to the Power Company. And so we left Texas. And Julia was about a few months old. And that we left and she slept all the way up to New Mexico. And we got a motel in New Mexico. And the minute we got in that hotel, she started yelling. And she yelled, and she yelled, and she screamed. And finally I said, you know, we're keeping everybody awake. We're keeping everybody awake in this hotel. And so we loaded up the car again about 1 a.m. and took off for Denver. And the minute we got out of there and got on the highway, not a peep out of her. She slept all the way to Denver.
Oh, well.
So that's how I got back to St. Joe.
So that was 1951.
Yeah.
So now we're up there.
Okay.
But we went to Denver quite often to see Arlene's folks lived in Denver. And we went out there to visit quite often.
What do you want to know about the
food? So I went to work for the company.
Where did you live when you moved back?
Your first little apartment was what, on Messina Street or somewhere? It was a nice big
apartment. We come back to St. Joe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where did you live when you came back?
Well, we lived with your folks.
You mean with who?
No, we lived with Mother we lived with Arlene's folks.
Yeah, they weren't moved yet. Yeah,
she had an apartment upstairs. And we occupied that apartment. And then, I was still in the Army when I came back to the States. And I'm leaving out a good chunk of this after we lived here for a few days. Then we moved to Colorado Springs.
What year was that? I wasn't born, was I?
Yeah, we moved to Colorado Springs and I was assigned to
was that before college?
No. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We moved to Colorado Springs, and I had to report back to the Army. And I got a notice to report back to this base hospital in at Colorado Springs. And we were out there. We had an apartment out there for Several months. In a little town outside of Colorado Springs, sort of a resort town. We got a basement apartment, and I was on call, but I never got called for several months. Stayed in the Army out there on call, yeah. And there's an adventure out there. All these people were big game hunters out of Colorado, and they shot a moose. And we had moose heads and stuffed bears in our apartment.
Oh, Mama,
you probably never thought much about that. And they had their moose head over the fireplace. And when we were in St. Joe, and we came back out to our apartment, it was cold. And we came in the apartment, and they never told them we were coming back. And it was cold in the apartment, and so I lit the fireplace was full of paper, newspaper. In fact, they put all their trash down in our basement, all our papers down in our basement, in the fireplace. So I struck a match and lit it and flipped it in the fireplace. And he went to the bedroom or someplace and came back out. And the moose, his whiskers were fell along, and his just barely gradually burning up. And I grabbed him and put the moose's beard out. And
well, when you got back here, you
and I got I did a barber job on that moose whiskers.
Oh, I was gonna say,
I combed these whiskers out and trimmed them and got the razor out, and that moose. His whiskers had shrunk that far, but they never did notice that. Never did notice that. But the moose's whiskers, if I hadn't walked out when I did, the moose wouldn't have had a whisker. Yeah. But we were out there till I was discharged.
Well, I wondered, mostly in St. Joe, you lived on Francis Street until you bought the house off Beck Road. So we just had two homes.
Yeah. Then when they got back after school, and down in Texas, and then in Colorado, and St. Joe's got a job. We had an apartment on 15th and Francis, big brick apartment. And so happened that our good friends, Arlene's good friend, they had the apartment. There's two houses built almost the same. There's an apartment up here, an apartment here. Nice apartments. And Madison's, Denton and Nadine Madison, had this apartment, we had that apartment, so we were just real close together. And we had an apartment, and we lived in that apartment several months, and then I bought a house at
17 Francis.
Yeah, 2817 Francis. And that was a nice neighborhood. And we lived in that little house for a number of years.
I was 14 when we moved.
Yeah. And you were like two or three when we lived there. We lived in the house for about 12 years.
Yeah, a long time. You remodeled it.
And then Mr. Cobb out in Belmore Addition, he built that addition, and he built him a home out there. And I was out there looking one day, and he said, Arlene and I were looking around out there, and we needed more room. And he said, my house is going to be for sale. He said, I haven't advertised it yet, but I've had a heart attack, severe heart attack, and I can't take care of this house anymore. And
it's sold.
It's for sale. Yeah. He said, one price. He said, I'm going to tell you what I want for it. He said, I'm going to go up or go down. But that's the price I'm asking. Well, it was fairly good price. It was $28,000. And we bought that house, and we lived in it for.
We lived in it until 2000.
Until your mother died. We lived in it for we lived in that house, sir.
Well, from 63 to about 2000.
You were 16.
14. I was not quite driving yet, so I was about 14.
I mean, when we moved out there, you were?
14. I was finishing my freshman year.
Yeah.
Because I was practicing cheerleading in the sliding glass store. I remember that.
And,
you lived there. But in the 50s, you joined the Masons. You
became, yeah. We had a superintendent at Lake Road Plant. He was a Masonic. I mean, he was really Masonic. And he talked to me, and I joined the Masons. And went to the Masons and joined Moila. And we had the country club for the kids all the time they were growing up. We had the pool and golf course. And my wife was she loved golf. And she and Nadine Madison would play out there. And they had a ladies. They had ladies' day every week. And she'd play out there, and I'd play with her. But it was nice for the kids.
Oh, it was heaven. What would you like to know about, like, the 50s? Anything?
Just whatever you want to tell me. What do you remember about the 50s?
The 50s was given over to building power plant.
Cool.
We put in the first generating unit. It went into Lake Road in 1951 or 2. And it was like in the power business, you went by pressure. I mean, 250-pound pressure was low pressure then. And that water treatment had to be so-and-so for this pressure. Then when you got up to 900 pounds, it had to be so-and-so. Then when you got to 2,000 pounds, it had to be so-and-so. Well, we were fighting, 950 pounds was the boiler pressure at that time that all the boilers in the States practically, they stopped at 950. Well, we didn't, I mean, it was almost like you did this and hoped it worked, and you knew you couldn't have so-and-so. And the 60s, it slacked off a little bit. Then we burnt the boiler down.
Yeah.
And
when did you get involved with the EPA? Didn't you do a lot of testing for the EPA in the 60s when?
In 1973, EPA was created, and then the power plant regulations went into effect. And it was kind of interesting because I got in on the EPA's birth, you might say. And I went to meetings in Jeff City and Columbia, the Water Commission, and the Fuels Commission. And sulfur was the big problem. And just coal around here. Then I got into coal chemistry, really deep into coal chemistry. And we visited mines in northwest Missouri and northwestern Kansas, Illinois. And we bought, and coal varied from pine to mine to section to section to section. And we looked for low sulfur coal. And of course, we did the chemistry of the coal. We did the coal chemistry. And we analyzed coal in our laboratory. And the company would buy so many tons of coal. It guaranteed so many million BTUs, pretty thermal units. And our laboratory would analyze the 10 cars of coal and report the BTU content. Well, they paid the company, the coal company, they guaranteed 10,500. If it was 9,500, they had to pay us. If it was over that, we paid them. And I never fudged a bit. I mean, if I analyze the sample of coal, if it was 9,700, it was 9,700. No thought but to back off. And the companies and the coal average from real nice high BTU up in this section to you get south, the BTUs would be, the coal would have a higher BTU content when you burn it. And you'd visit a mine and take samples and bring them home and analyze them. Or you'd look at the layers of coal. There'd be a layer of coal, the layer of clay, and the layer of coal. And you'd be surprised on some of the, looking into the face of the coal, you see little animals that had been
petrified.
Million years, maybe. It was, their little bodies would be in this clay. Anyways, the chemist, and then I'm talking about something you all don't know about.
My head's about to hit.
Slagging.
Yeah. I want you to talk about, you retired from Light and Power, but talk about how you and George, and how you got involved in Rubidoux Row.
After I retired in 1985, George Heckel was up at Rubidoux Row, and George was on the
St. Joe Historical.
He was later president, but he was involved in Rubidoux Row, and he was president. And we were neighbors and good friends. And he said, Earl, he said, while you're involved, he said, you're retired now. He said, I got a little job up here at Rubidoux Row that you'd help us with. So I went up to Rubidoux Row, and 16 years later, I retired.
Only because you couldn't see anymore to do the tour.
Yeah, and it had just really started to have visitors. And the St. Joseph Historical Society owns Rubidoux Row. And a lot of people confuse it. We'll send a check to Rubidoux Row. Well, that Rubidoux Row has existed as an entity. The banks just automatically. But I was a docent there off and on for 16 years. And
what about the gardens? The gardens?
Yeah. I was a docent there for 16 years off and on. We'd have school kids. They used to be on field trips of third graders. All the schools in town, every May, they'd make a stop at Rubidoux Row. And we'd have 500 kids come through. Myself and Marcy Poe, or Marcy, whoever would work with me. I enjoyed taking the kids. It'd be a school bus, come in and unload the kids, and they send them down. And I tell them a little bit about St. Joseph, and how the row got started, and they spend about an hour there, 15 minutes to row and 10 minutes to get loaded up. And this went on for quite a few years until they got cut back on their
budget,
tours, what have you, and they couldn't take tours every year. So it was just starting that when I got busy, when I didn't do so much. But Miss Hankowski took care of the little garden out and back, little flower garden out and back. And when she retired, before she retired, I helped for a year. And we had the garden, Arlene and I took care of the garden for 16 years. And it was beautiful, it was big. People used to come down from Iowa just to look at the garden.
Weddings, many.
Or the people would come over to look at the row and then look at the garden.
You spent every day at the Rubidoux row.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then when you first started was when they took it over and made it the attraction it is now. You and George, and who were some of the names, the old names from St. Joe that really did it, and you got the basement excavated, you got the air conditioning in, and you...
Yeah.
You were in on all that.
Oh yes, in fact, I was on the board several times, and I was the conservative members. Those people up there, they were endowed. We had about $200,000 in endowment money, and they won't spend that money. I shouldn't say this.
Frank Ledger was.
They won't spend that money rather loosely. And for projects, you know, that actually wanted to buy a building one time. Well, we can buy this building for $35,000. You know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. What if you know, the roof and the paint, and you just can't do it. You can't do it. We need that money over here. And we did need it over at the row. So we had to put a basement under the building later on. But...
Which is the one you see if you go there and underneath? That's
there was four of us on the board, five of us on the board, like a Supreme Court decision. It'd be 5-4. Four of us would want, four would want to spend the money, four wouldn't spend the money, and the swing vote was the fifth of us.
Your generation and my generation, mine wanted to spend the money.
And I had very influential people in this town would come to me and say, Earl, women, say, we're not on the board anymore. We're getting too old to be active. But please don't let them spend our money. I tell them, well, I'll do all I can. I just won't vote. But,
and you and Mom were the first of the 21 most important people that Marshall White wrote about.
Yeah.
Your activities down there. She was not as excited as she sort of got drug along for the gardening expertise.
We had... The row grew. We grew the row. Then they had parties down underneath it. But they didn't get any state or government money because they were not a public. If we had joined with the city and doing something, then they would have been. But we opted to stay independent. So we had to raise our money ourselves. And they did a pretty good job, too. And you'd be surprised, the questions have been awful good to us. And then we'd take bus trips. Buses would come in from, you name it, they'd stop at the row for a visit. And then in 2000, around 2000, somebody had the idea of a Rubidoux reunion. A fellow from Hawaii came in, a Rubidoux, and he said, why don't you all have raise some money, have a festival, have a Rubidoux festival. So we got the idea of, we put out flyers all over the states and Canada, to the Rubidoux, and the St. Joseph Rubidoux established this. And he was the father of the Western movement.
Many.
And we had Rubidoux from Canada, New York, Georgia, Louisiana. We had Rubidoux from all over the United States who came here to a reunion. And they still have that reunion.
Now, Joseph Rubidoux had so many relations because you said he was fur trapping at the time Lewis and Clark were here, so he was like spreading his little joy everywhere.
They had, we had...
Bless his own children.
Probably had a Rubidoux here from Hawaii and Canada. And as I say, from Georgia and... I remember from Georgia particularly, a young man came up, he was about 16, 15 or 16, And on the remodeling, George Haeckel saved all the square nails that they pulled out of the boards from 100 years ago. And he wanted a square nail. And I said, I'll see if I can find you a square nail. So I had a whole bunch of them at home. So I took him over to square nail. And I remember he wanted me to stand out in the garden with him. And he was holding up his square nail and taking pictures of me and his square nail. Okay.
Okay. What was the interest in history like at that time in the rest of St. Joseph? Was it just kind of a small group of people that were interested in the restoration of Ruby
yeah.
Row? Or not a lot of interest in the rest of the community?
The rest of the community, I would say, no, it wasn't a community project. It was spearheaded by Mary Boder. Mm-hmm. And Mary Boder and Dr. Grimes, BB, and
George, and George Richmond. George Richmond was involved, wasn't he? George Richmond?
George Richmond. And
George Haeckel.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of people worked on it.
They sort of did it themselves.
But no, it wasn't a community effort. It was private. It was mostly volunteers. People interested in the historical society would come up and work on the row. Because they bought it from the Rubidoux in St. Louis. See, when Joseph died, Joseph Rubidoux was born in St. Louis, and he came to St. Joe. But he still had interest in St. Louis. And when he passed away, the row went to a family in St. Louis. And he sold it to the Historical Society, this Rubidoux. And he would come up to the reunions. In fact, I invited him up. Personally invited him up to a reunion, and he came up from, and their license plate was Rubidoux. Mm-hmm.
You were kind of lone wolves. You all just banded together and made that what it is now, really.
Yeah.
You just really pushed forward and made wise decisions.
Well, like when we did the basement. It all had to be hand carried. The dirt had to be hand carried out because they're afraid they'd disturb the rest of the building. They rented the building. They rented the basement all the time they were doing the work on the restoration on the basement. And they'd track out a wheelbarrow, and they'd work them and come in, and the floors would be absolutely filthy at night. And it would have a party there that night. Somebody ran it for a party. And at 4:30, 4 o'clock when they left, Marcy Poole, it's Marcy.
What is her name now? We're big at Heartland. What's her name? She's doing the tourist thing. Marcy Bennett. Bennett.
Yeah.
Bennett, that's her married name. Marcy Bennett is her married name.
Yeah, Marcy Bennett. Yeah. It's Marcy Bennett now. And I'm sorry.
You're fine, got it.
It's Marcy Bennett now. Marcy was up there. He worked as an assistant to Roy Coy. And she and I and young man named John, who was a maintenance, who helped up there. We come in at 4 o'clock and we bring the hoses in and just literally hose that basement down. and the back part of the basement where they were working was just open to blah. And we hung long pieces of plastic across the back.
Where the kitchen is now.
On ropes to put pictures up, and we get that deal done for he get it done for a party. That'd be once a week, probably. And I'll say this, Marcy Bennett, she worked very hard up there. And she ran practically every place she went. And she kept up with her. But
Mom used to worry when you retired what the heck she was going to do with you, and it was never a problem because he was always at the row. Yeah,
yeah. I came over. That garden took up. Oh, you'd have to go over there every day. And it was so big. You'd have to go over there every day and water or pull weeds. We got a rose garden. They gave us a bunch of beautiful roses. I made a rose garden up on top. And
perennials rolled over just perfectly. You always had blooms. Always had blooms. And
yeah.
You retired, who took it over?
Yeah.
When you retired, who took over the garden?
When I retired?
The garden club.
It went to the garden committee. And the garden committee, who they got to do it? I don't know.
They tore everything up and put in herbs because that's what Joseph would have had. They tore out. I'll bring a picture.
They tore out the rose garden and.
It's pretty as.
I'm not criticizing now.
I am.
It was just a change of command.
I'm being mother here.
They took out the rose garden and just let the big garden go to pot.
All your perennials are gone. Everything's gone.
Clyde Weeks was. Took over as director, and he couldn't do it all himself. And he tried to, but it finally wasn't the garden that we had.
It was the garden you took over and made beautiful, is what it was.
But after
that, you sort of just sat down and did your gorgeous needlework. Mm-hmm.
You
wouldn't have believed.
Frank Fletcher that ran the, actually, he was a, he was at Ruby de Rove. Frank will get me aside and he said, now Earl, he was president of the board. Earl, we got all this money. Why not spend some money? Can't do it, Frank. Can't do it. Frank Fletcher was instrumental up there. After my wife died, she was just as healthy as you and I are today. And she came home, she just had a physical, and the doctor told her she was in good health, and, you know, come back in a year for another physical, or 6 months. But all I was trying to tell her, she was tired. Awful tired.
She had every reason to
tired all the time.
My mother
and the doc missed the diagnosis. And she had the incurable leukemia. And they finally did the blood test.
Oh, it was just a simple CBC when I took her in.
Simple CBC. And they picked up that her white corpuscles, mm-hmm. her white cells were out of control and misshapen, and they diagnosed it as incurable.
Myelocytic leukemia.
And she just lived.
4 months.
Yeah, they.
6 months, though.
They diagnosed it. Yeah, she lived not quite 6 months.
Four months.
Four months after she was diagnosed.
I took my mother into the emergency.
And we were just on. We just were shocked.
Yeah, our family lives until they die. I mean, we live until we die all the way through. And we never, but she was short of breath and I took her in and I said, I think it's her heart. I knew all the nurses.
She lived 4 months after she was diagnosed with leukemia.
Tell my mother in about 2 hours that she was dying.
Then I lived in my house for a few more months. Then I lived out of the living community. And we were out there for a number of months.
We meaning that dog ears.
Yeah. And she and I were talking. She said her house, on the side of her house, she had a real blank side to it. And she said, you sold your house.
In a week.
For a very reasonable amount. And she said, why don't we take the money you got from your house and we'll put an apartment on my house. So she built a beautiful room for me.
Dylan's and I sat there and just walked through
and,
it. 7-year-old in a wheelchair, but still,
it was,
so we could use it as a master bedroom sometimes. So we put 700 square feet on, and he has a lovely room and close to the French doors. And
I have a lovely room. And have a.
All my inheritance is in it. Big room.
It's, you wouldn't believe it till you saw it. It's a big room. But then I spent most of my money I sold my house for to build this room, because I just paid it. I would have paid it.
You would have paid it a living community.
And in rent. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We decided to do.
That's smart.
We decided to do that.
Yeah. So he didn't move very far from home. We live on Ashland, right up by Beck Road. So
yeah.
You ended up close to home. So that's my dad's life.
Yeah, we can go up there now.
We don't need one yet very far from home.
So that's my story up to date. Mm-hmm. I'm living with my daughter in my apartment.
His new daughter.
Oh, I forgot to ask you how you met your wife.
How I met my wife.
Mm-hmm. You got a little bit more time.
Well, I met Don Jones, who's a good friend of mine, and we double dated one time. And I was dating this girl, Marie, and Don was dating Arlene. And I never thought much about it. And we just stopped double dating for some reason. And I never saw my wife for months after that. And I was downtown one day, and I was down by the old Kresge's Dime Store, there on the corner of 6th and Felix, and Plymouth.
What year was this?
This was 1941. And I looked across the street, I was there on the sidewalk, and they were raffling a car off over at the old Plymouth building across the street. And this one girl came out, and the girl came up behind her. And I said, "Oh, that's Arlene Silverthorne." I said, I wonder if I could have it. I said, and I fell in love with her right then. Right then and there, I fell in love with my wife. And I'd seen her before, you know, never said anything about it. And I thought, well, if I call her, if she'd give me a date. And I called her, and she did agree to go to the show with me. And that's how I met her. And we went together for...
Well, the war sort of pushed to a short courtship.
Oh, well, let's see. About a year. Close to a year.
The war sort of pushed you.
Yeah. I was so through OCS. It was... and we dated for about a year. And then we're married. At the old little Methodist church up here that's torn down now. It's Ashland United Methodist Church now. Ashland and another church went together and built the church they're building. I mean, this little church went together with another church and they built Ashland. But we were married in that little church over on 3rd Street.
You said it was so cold and so snowy, and you had to
stand. Oh, it was November the 17th. And it was before we had climate change. And believe me, I believe in the climate change.
We're not.
It was cold and miserable and snowy. And my brother was my best man. And we had to go up some steps and back and stand on the porch outside until the... So the procession all got in, you know, when the groom comes in. And we were about freezing to death out there. And we walked in that church, and just like a blast of hot air hit us.
A funny story Mom told to match his one about the beautiful Italian.
Mm-hmm.
She was very good with the dollar. And Mom had a good job, lived at home for free during the war. Dad was an officer with overseas pay, so that she bankrolled them like crazy. She had lots of money. They had money. And she loved beautiful clothes, so she would go to Einbender's or somewhere, and she worked, where'd she work, at Swift's?
Swift.
And beautiful heels, and she had a beautiful figure.
Oh, Neil was at Swift's.
Yeah, so she was talking about walking to work one day, and she didn't know why in the world she did it, because she had on her brand new heels, and they were $28, and her suit was some $50, and Dad's like, and the more she talked about her suit and her clothes and stuff, he goes, you mean I was sloshing up the boot of Italy and you were running around in your $28? These all happen at dinner tables. And the boys are just like falling on the floor because Dad said, you were buying that. Blah, blah, blah. She goes, oh, Earl, we had enough money to buy a car and house when you got out. So it's kind of cute. Their stories. But well, I guess that wraps your life up. Now you got to go home to Coco and...
Yeah, I'll go...
Dinner.
Don't
start on that dog.
I had a little dog called Moochie.
Here come the
dogs. Little Moochie was a Shih Tzu. I got him when he was 8 weeks old, and had him for 14 years, and he died. He died about just before Christmas.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I cried, and cried, and cried while the little dog had died.
Until I went in,
and we had a thing going for us. I had him every week from 8 weeks old till he died.
Yeah, and he bit all of us and peed all over my rugs, and he was a pill. But and, we replaced him quickly with Coco.
Harlan talked it. She checked at the dog pound, and she said, "Well, we'll go down and look at the little dogs. They got a little dog down there." And we looked at Coco, and Coco, she sued both of us. And, of course, I'm going to die a long time before Coco
yeah,
does.
Yeah, I had to pick a dog that I could... Coco is a half Chihuahua, half Rat Terrier, and she's really cute.
See, I'll be 97 tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh, you will?
Saturday.
Oh. Saturday, yeah. I'm sorry. I'll be 97 Saturday.
Yep, and he has outlived everybody, except my aunt. We still have Aunt Doris, Mom's sister. And in fact, I gave a history. I was having some testing done, and they wanted to go through family history. I kept saying, no heart disease, no this, no that. And finally, the doctor goes, what does your family die from?
I said, so she thought, I didn't think about it at the time. I think Julia thought I better have another little dog.
I had to do something. I couldn't take the wailing and flailing and carrying on in your room. So. Coco knew which side her butter. She got right up in your face and licked. We'll take her. That'll work. She chases her pit bull all over.
This is the cross between a
Chihuahua and a Rat Terrier.
Rat Terrier.
It's a lovely mix.
Julia has a pit bull. Her son has a pit bull.
He doesn't like
and those dogs are identical in color.
They look exactly alike. 80 pounds, 10 pounds.
Identical.
And Scrappy likes to bang at her and Dylan's came over to fix something the other day. The kid that's the engineer up there lives up the street.
So I got
came down and he said, "Is that the new Moochie?" And he said, "Yeah."
She'll never be another Moochie. But
so does my husband.
She'll fit.
She's fine. So that's Earl Myers' life in 3 hours.
All right.
Anything else?
I don't have anything else. But is there anything else you wanna share before we're done?
No.
All right.
And I'll bring a picture of you.